Welcome back to Good Mood Podcast, where each episode promises to delve into the mosaic of Jeff Amos's life experience. I'm your host, Liz Leach, and I'm pleased to introduce you to this podcast. Jeff was born and bred in Sowerby Bridge, Coldale, West Yorkshire, where he's lived for over 70 years. This series of podcasts captures his story of growing up in Sowerby Bridge and how he entered into the world of performing arts and music. This podcast guarantees to provide an informative insight into life since the 1940s and opens up a perspective of how someone can choose to dedicate their life to creativity. Please subscribe to this podcast to be able to be alerted of new episodes, and also share this with friends and family who you think would be interested in the topic. When you have time, why not visit Jeff's website to find out more information about the work that he's done, which is jeffamos.wordpress.com. We hope you enjoy this episode.
That's the old church. You know, you go up past the Blind Pig, up there, and on the left there's a chapel. That old one was burnt down by a couple of lads playing in the cellar with matches.
So whereabouts? So you were saying this is where it all started.
Yeah, for me.
This is where you were born.
Yeah.
On this. So whereabouts is this?
This is Chapel Street. It's gone now.
Okay.
And the street behind it's gone. The street in front of it has gone. Some clearances, you know. No inside toilets. That was.
So these are the yards outside then, aren't they?
Well, that's a midin. So inside there are dustbins and the outside toilets that you shared.
Right,
so it doesn't come more humble.
Luxury. Luxury living there.
Yeah.
These are like your typical terrace houses of the area, aren't they?
Absolutely.
And cobble streets.
Yep.
So whereabouts, even though the street's not there now, whereabouts is that in Sowerby Bridge then?
Well, it's just going up Old Tour Lane, you know, past the Blind Pig.
Yeah.
Up there.
Yeah.
Yeah, got it. Well, that's, you go up that road. That used to be Chore Lane. That used to come down and then it turned sharp left and ran down. If you imagine, Chore Lane is here now, running down into Sowerby Bridge.
Right.
It's above Lidl.
Yeah.
There's a zebra crossing.
Yeah.
And a tower block.
Yes, I know.
Well, that's where the road used to run.
So earlier when you were saying that there were a chapel that burnt down here, is now St. Paul's?
Yeah, that's it. They had the same, when they built it, they just used exactly to the inch the same land that was there.
Yeah.
And it was all posh because all this is redstone and what used to call donkey stone. It was like a chalk stone that they'd the threshold of going through the front door, the doorstep,
mm-hmm.
you used to either use white, yellow, or red.
Yeah.
And if you didn't do it, you were the talk of all the girls on the street. You know,
So that was how to keep your standards.
Yeah. Dreadful accommodation inside.
What was it like inside?
Horrible. With a cellar that really wasn't worth using. And then, so we just had the one room there, and then there was my mum's bedroom, and then me and my brothers were up there in the attic bedroom.
In the attic. So it was basically one room downstairs, one room on the first floor, and then your attic room.
Yeah.
And how many of there was you in the attic then?
How many was there?
How many of there? How many brothers?
Oh, with three brothers, I guess. So there was two beds in there, then my mum and dad down on that one.
On that one. So that's where you grew up. And what was it like living there? And what did your parents do? What were they?
Well, my mum didn't, because the kids came along fairly regular for a while. And my dad at that time he might have still been working for Fletcher's, which is a dye house by, you can see it over Northbridge, Dinclough.
Okay.
But it was independent of Dean Clough, but I think they did a lot of work for them.
Right. And it was on the same site as Dean Clough?
Yeah.
Because
it's
a massive site.
Oh, it's half a mile long.
Is it?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
So I don't know when he moved, but then he worked to a company called Sega Richards. Everybody called it Sega Dicks, who used to be a textile thing. And then some members of the family changed tack a bit and went into engineering, into like a foundry. And they developed, from what I can remember, this alloy of bronze and something else that apparently stood up to massive heat. And all the armed forces used to use it, like especially the Navy, in their engines and things. That's all I know about it, really. But an American company, Staveley Industries, moved in about, I don't know, mid-50s.
Into that same
style. Yeah, and bought it out, of course, and tried to make them work American style.
Okay.
Well, it took them 3 years, but they got seen off. Right. They were just straight, we're not working like that, you know. It's, they beat them. Yeah.
So the people that work in there just wasn't willing to accept it.
No,
just kind of.
It wasn't being pig-headed. They knew what they were doing, you know. They, but no, it was all, you're coming in early, we want you to work overtime for no, you know, all that crap.
Yeah.
You know, and how many bank holidays do you want? You know, it was all trying to change all that.
Okay.
And they were heavily unionised.
I was just about to ask if you were unionised.
Yeah. There was a lot around in those days, of course. And across the other side of the street is one of these middens. So it was stone built, a bit more than that height. So the toilets were down this side, and then down the other side were where all the dustbins were put. So you'd often be in the toilet talking to a rat or two.
It was
when you look, it was grim, but.
So we're looking at a painting at them. Is it a painting
Or a drawing? It's a print.
A print.
But, yeah.
So
was it Peter Blake, I think?
Yeah.
Who taught art in Sobey Bridge.
Okay.
And he taught it at Ryburn as well as at what was the grammar school at the time. Yeah. And for some reason, he fell in love with this particular street. There's 6 or 7 different paintings.
Yeah, yeah.
So, some from what I would call the West End there, facing where Chewell Lane, and this is taken from the East End going
towards,
that way.
Right. Yeah. So when you look at the picture, there's laundry hung across the street on a line, and there's cobbled streets, and there's just one solitary car, isn't there?
When I was growing up little there wasn't ever a car. And this would be, there's a bit of license going off here, I think, because I'm not sure about all them bloody, they're the very first TV aerials.
Is that what they are on the top?
Yeah,
right.
But there was only one house, Maud Blackburn's, just about here, that had a TV when we were there. And so I think, you know, he's used a bit of license, but it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And so people wouldn't have had the money to do that, you know.
So on that whole street, which we're looking at, even just in that picture, there's probably about 20 houses.
Oh, easy. And then this curves round here, so there's more houses around there. The perspective is sort of that end and that end are together, but the way he's painted it hasn't seen it, you know.
So what was it like growing up there? As a young kid?
Just grew up, you didn't know any different, you know. I was quite poorly, I had pneumonia. And almost pneumonia again before I was 5 years old, maybe 4. I have a very, very vague memory of I was at home. There were times when you wouldn't be in hospital, you'd just be at home. And so I was down the front room, there was a fire blazing away. And I do remember my dad just sort of stroking my brow a bit and just saying, you'll be all right.
Mm.
At that age, it's little snapshots and vignettes of, you know, not alike to anything. I do remember that very well still. But
you didn't, at that age, you didn't have a childhood when you were out running around and playing, so you were at home quite a lot.
I was kept in quiet a bit.
Yeah.
But then played out a bit and you wandered the streets and... Mm. Whatever, you know, just I've always been I'll go down here and see what's down here, even still am now, you know. So,
exploring,
but it's a cliche, but kids didn't know we were poor, you know, you just what it was, you know, you were there, that was where you lived, and what have you.
So at that time, were a lot of the because Sowerby Bridge has got quite a few. Factories and the industry.
Oh, it was massive at one time.
Yeah. So a lot of the mills that are now offices and were actually burnt. Active.
You know, that used to be a regular occurrence.
Did it?
Oh, yeah. Somebody put a match to them for insurance, you know.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It was prevalent everywhere, that. On this, when you get to that far street there, you could turn a left and go over bridge steps down to a puzzle.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then if you turn around there and go up, that's Industrial Road. There was, on the left-hand side going up, there was a confectioner's. Mattox used to make toffee bonbons and stuff. And a bit further up was a company called Siddle & Hilton who made beds for hospitals and tubular seating for buses and things like that. But again, I didn't know for a while after that, although I met the son of the family in a jazz club, funnily enough, when I was about 15, 16. Mm-hmm. And they also had... on Wharf Street, they had a big factory there that used to be Pollitt and Wigzell's that made these wonderful steam engines.
Uh-huh.
And they moved in there when that sort of, I don't know why that finished, but you get different electricity going then, I guess. And they, I think they made more modern hospital beds there, you know. So, mm-hmm. Yeah. There was over 60 different industries in Sorbing Bridge. I can't find it. I used to have like a yearbook, 1965 or something like that. And it was full, heavy engineering, machine tool, light engineering. And at the back of where the Sturt Bridge is, you can walk along the river to where the old market used to be. Well, just as you get to the end there was John's Toffees there.
Yeah.
They made largely fudge. And then as I grew up, I saw it everywhere. And what they used to do with, they made it in Sorby Bridge, and you'd find it in all the seaside places. You know, welcome to here, welcome. But it was made here. Yeah. And then there was Mattox, then there was John's Toffees, and then just below the Hog's Head.
Yeah.
Across that, where there's a little bit of a car park.
Car park, yes.
There used to be Lums.
Yeah.
And they used to make boiled sweets.
Oh my
And
word.
They used to do like boiled sweet lollies.
Right. So that's what's called, that area is now Causey. Is it called Causey?
Well, it's called Causey because that was the original road through Sorby Bridge.
Ah.
Medieval times.
Oh, right. I didn't realise that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's where that road used to run.
Yeah. Right. And it ran across where the canal cuts now across it, you know, the back of the rocks there.
Yeah.
And they used to do, we all used to like the traffic light lollies. They had, you know, three different colours. And I can see this even now. The vans were red and they had a big painting or whatever it was of the lollies on there. And it was Lums lollies, take some licking, and it was TEK and licking was LIKK.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it was a different town in many ways then, wasn't it? It was all
very,
that going on.
Full employment at that time.
Yeah.
I mean, I didn't know, I was too young then, but looking back, I know early 50s right through until even the late 60s, it was still not too bad.
Mm.
But some of the textiles were going.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. So there were textiles in the town, there were sweet making, I didn't have any idea, but sweet making was a thing.
Yeah, engineering
in town.
Of all sorts. Right. And pattern makers, you know, for foundries. You know, there was a foundry up that street a bit further. Just loads of stuff.
So there was a foundry in Sorby Bridge as well?
Yeah. Well, there was the first one was where Little's is now.
Okay.
William Bates. And apparently, as far as I can remember, they were pretty, one of the leaders in the country about cast iron work as well.
Right.
So they were in there, you know.
So really mix of different industries and stuff going on in the area.
Yeah.
So you were saying that you weren't well in the early years of your life and you was at home, pneumonia before the age of five. So what's your first memory of being at school then? Because you would have been...
I don't know which came first. Shall we sit down anyway?
Yeah.
Just sit anyway. How was it going? There was a school up Chewell Lane.
Mm.
Do you know Rose Hill? There's a little cobbled road that goes up just above where the tower block is. I mean, we may have a walk round actually at some stage. if you like, you know. Mm. This is why I think it's going to be a big thing, this, really, in terms of time, but we'll see, you know.
Yeah.
And so when you walk up past the tower block on Tower Hill, that's where it's blocked off now. That's where the road used to come down. So you go on to Chuller Lane proper and then walk up just a few yards, and on your right, there's houses there now. There was Ellison Memorial School there, which was a Church of England school.
Okay.
And there was a nursery.
Right, all on the same side.
Yeah, and it went through. So I know I went to nursery there. I've got a memory of you had an afternoon nap.
Right.
and you had little fold-down beds, you know, that you got on. Mine was grey and it had an elephant on it. I can remember that. Miss Knott. It's interesting what sticks in your mind. I can't remember much. I think I was a bit of a lad then because she was trying to get me out from under some chairs I'd been using as a den.
Yeah,
it was so all fun because she was laughing. I can remember that.
Yeah.
But also, we used to get a glass at dinner time, I think it was, a glass of orange juice.
Get your vitamin C.
Oh, but after war, you see, that's I was born, you know, 1947, so I'd be there very early 80s. So there was, I can remember the last rationing.
Right.
I try not to butterfly around. But, yeah, so then, and we had a dessert spoonful of malt.
All right, okay.
That was to help, and a cod liver oil capsule, which most of us stuck up there, and you get a back slap. But you know, it was fine. At that age, you didn't understand, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But
it's an insight, isn't it? Because I don't think for children going to school now, there's none of that.
And of course, we had milk as well. Yeah, the little Jill.
Yeah,
I've forgotten the milk.
So that kind of taking care of children were really paramount then, wasn't it?
Oh,
at that time?
Needed to build
getting nutrition back up. Yeah,
because I had very, very bad asthma then. Very bad, which was tied
so
in.
Was that after you'd had pneumonia, or was that it would have been after?
It came,
wouldn't it?
It came after.
Yeah.
I mean, I now know that on my dad's side of the family, it's prevalent.
Okay.
Asthma. And
so it's in
some
the family.
People, on the male side mainly, but there were one or two of my female cousins had it, you know, but not too bad. And so that's the school I went to. Then I must have had time out because I think I had it twice, you know, pneumonia. Because my next memory is being older, 6, maybe 5. And we were doing Music and Movement that BBC used to put out, you know, on the radio. And everyone else was in just sort of shorts or knickers and a vest. I had a pullover on and I had my socks on. And I don't know quite how many, but there were one or two people, I think it was a man and a woman, talking to the teacher, and they were looking at me and talking about me, and I can just remember them saying, "How's he doing?" And she said, he doesn't seem too bad. As you can see, we've kept some clothes on him, you know. And the next thing I remember at that it sort of age group was into class, because I must have been off a long time, I think. And so the teacher then came down and said, "Look, can you read, Jack?" I said, "Yeah." "Oh," she said, "oh, okay, can you read this?" And it was stupidly simple at that age for me. And I saw her face just absolutely change. I thought, "What's wrong? What's wrong?" My dad had been teaching me, you know.
So your dad had been keeping up with you?
Yeah.
With your learning and your education?
Yeah. And she said, "Just stay there. Just stay there, Deborah." And off she went, and you know, I didn't know at the time, but she brought this lovely looking old lady down who must have been head. And she said, "Can you read this?" So I said, "Yeah," blah, blah. And they both looked at each other, you know, and they said, "Where did you learn the reading?" At the time, I'm not if I can imagine this response, but I think I'd just gone, "Well, home," you know. Yeah.
So even though you'd not been at school, you'd still been getting, reading. You'd still been learning and getting that education.
At least the reading, I can't remember.
Yeah.
I might have been writing, I think.
Yeah, as well.
It's appalling even now, right, my writing. But we had different coloured inks you could use.
Uh-huh.
And it was a pen with a nib that you put on, you know, so it was not much above a goose quill.
Right.
Really, I would have thought. But there was green, black, blue and red, I think. I chose the green for some reason.
So when you put the nibs on, did you use, like, loose ink?
Or Oh, yeah.
So you did, like, a quill in it. Yeah.
Oh, yes, you had. In fact, come here, I'll show you something that allies to that, because this is, like, it's not the same, but it's...
along them lines. Look,
I've just come through, because I've just moved beds here.
Ah.
I've closed half the house down for the winter.
Oh,
so
okay.
We're calling this the winter palace room.
This is
so
the winter
a much
palace.
Bigger room in there is normally. So this is exactly the same desk.
Oh, that is the school
ink,
desk.
With the inkwell.
Oh, yeah.
And the chair I would have had. So I've sanded them all down and I'm going to wax them over the winter.
Oh, they are lovely. Where did you get them from?
Well, it was on eBay, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Not too far. And the guy had quite a few.
And so, you open them, that's very powerful.
Yeah, that's it. It's massive of ink, spilled ink in there.
Yeah,
so I'm not going to rub that off.
And that ridges here, that would have been where you get the pen.
And pencils, yeah.
Wow.
Brilliant.
It's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, when you think about what schools have now, it's like, well, it's all... not like I've been to school for a long time, but a lot of it's screens and computers, isn't it? Like, that's a piece of craftsmanship right there in that desk, isn't it?
Just to finish off at that school, they got a new teacher in. And I know I didn't imagine this. I mean, I think I was quite sensitive to people's faces change. I put my hand up, wanted to go to the toilet, and teacher said, no, you should have gone playtime. No, even then, you know, well, if you don't want to go, I'm thinking, what? So it went on, and I asked her three times, and I'm convinced she was a malevolent-looking hooker.
Mm.
She said, to me, she seemed to be, there was a grin that was, you know...
Like she was getting some kind of enjoyment out of having that
so
control.
Eventually, you'd better go, and of course, I just messed myself, didn't I, when I got there.
Oh, no.
So she sent somebody out to look for me, and he went back and said, Miss, he's gone mad.
Mm.
You know, it's just... And I remember she took me into a little bit of a kitchen. She had to wash me down while somebody went to get my mum.
Oh, no.
You know, so it served her fucking right.
But to have to go through that as a kid, it's not right, is it? And it's like in front of your peers and your friends, and to be treated like that is not... Right, but is that when the little streak of rebellion started, do you think?
I think so, yeah. I thought, I'm not having this. And to this day, I swear blind, you know, I told Margaret about it, that I didn't misinterpret that smile, you know.
Mm.
It was, well, whatever.
How did you respond to school after experiencing that then? Because that's like, it can just shake you up completely, can't it, when you're beaten.
I can't remember much after that.
Yeah.
So it is still, you know, little vignettes of your early school days, really.
So that would have been still in the nursery, primary.
Well, it would. Well, I don't know. No, it was a year or so up from the nursery.
Right. So you were still really young.
Yeah, and so from just remembered this bit from there we were talking about the health giving thing.
Yeah.
So. Allen House, do you know where Allen House is? Just by the bottom of the road coming down from Norland, before you go up to the station. But just below Allen Park.
Yes, that's right.
It's all private there.
Mm-hmm.
And me and Pamela Barber had to go down for, you put the goggles on, you know, for a lot. It was that sun ray treatment for chest, bad chest.
Oh, I don't know what that is.
Ah, well, you put fucking goggles on like that.
Yeah.
And it was like... a heat ray lamp, but it was more than that, which is why it was a hot, and you had to wear these very dark goggles
to protect your eyes.
Yeah,
Yeah.
And
was it like a sunbed then? That kind of thing?
Well, yeah, but very old-fashioned thing.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and I guess that was a lot to do with tuberculosis as well.
Okay.
Still, that would have been pretty much right. In
so you'd have that treatment to stave off any more problems?
Hopefully. I don't know if it worked or not, but my asthma stopped when I, just about a year before I actually entered puberty, which our local new young GP had told my mum and dad, we'll see how he goes. He's coming up to puberty. I didn't understand that word, and but we'll see. He could either come out of it and he won't be bothered for a long number of years, or he won't, and he'll be ill probably for all of his life. And again, it's that little thing that sticks. So you're down to your singlet and your underpants, underwear. And Pamela Barber, when I see her, I'm going to really let rip with her. She conned me.
In what way?
She said, let me see yours and then I'll show you mine. So I did that. And just when she was about to go like that, a bloody nurse come in and we both got banned from doing it. We got sent home. We were together at Ryburn. I haven't seen her since, but, you know.
Oh, well, you wait until
it's
that
here.
Moment.
It's
wait until
here.
That day.
And I'll wait for the most embarrassing moment I can for her.
Yeah.
Yeah, dear me. But, yeah.
So she's been hiding from you ever since then?
It's not, yeah. I'm sure in some of it we'd have met up. So
she'd probably gone.
But that was, yeah.
So, yeah.
That's when I realised that women...
we know how to get us own way. Absolutely
right. Yeah, that was a lesson learned very early on. But you know, it's and I mean,
so from there you went to secondary school, but what was it? Was it comprehensive?
Well, it was before comprehensive in a sense, but it was it was sort of streamed, I suppose. I mean, I didn't really understand it. At 10 and 11, what was going down, really. But so the, shall we call them the senior schools?
Yeah.
Not talking about the grammar school, you know, just about the secondary school, secondary modern. There was still single sex. So the boys went to Bolton Brow, which is now an infant junior school.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
I do, yeah.
And the girls were just up here above, which is...
Kept you separate.
By a long bloody way, yeah. And so that went on. I went 1959 into Bolton Brow. No, 1958. And then... Easter term, early summer term, 1959, that's when we moved to the brand new school.
Which one was that then?
That's at Ryburn.
Okay,
which has been completely rebuilt again. And our year group, the first year group, were the ones to have co-educational, you know, lads and lasses in.
Yeah.
But the older ones didn't. As they went through second, third, fourth year leaving, they were single sex there.
And so Ryburn School's quite a way out, Sobby. It's not really in the centre, is it? It's quite a bit of a walk out. But
no, but, you know, the land was there.
That's right. So that must have been a bit of a novelty then, being one of the first years to have girls and boys together in the same...
Yeah, it did not happen that year. But then we got a bit older, you know.
Things started to occur.
It worked okay, and I've many fond memories of Ryburn.
Yeah.
I think it was a good school. What was he called? Clegg. He was the head of the West Riding, as it was then, education.
Right.
And this was his dearest wish to get this type of school going. And you could see, now when I look back, maybe not quite right in a sense that we couldn't do languages because we weren't grammar school kids.
Mm-hmm.
But I think his heart was in the right place, to be honest, because we did sewing the first year, which was cool for me. Well, sort of. but then you did a lot of practical stuff at school.
Mm-hmm.
There was a full-blown garden, market garden type thing, you know, which you you did at least 1 year there.
Mm-hmm.
There was a metalworking shop,
right,
and two woodworking shops.
Mm-hmm.
And later on, there was a cooking thing, but they wouldn't let the land, it wasn't for boys, you know.
So there's some of them views about what's a woman's role and what's a
oh yeah,
role
it was there.
That,
yeah. You see, my dad is already teaching me how to cook.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened to my oldest son actually there. And but it was all right. We learnt a lot.
Yeah.
No fucking exam. No homework.
No exam at all.
I can't believe what these poor kids are put through now. You know. Yeah.
There's a lot of pressure, isn't there?
Two hours a day, and then there's weekends. Yeah. But they're missing that thing about playing. That's part of life.
Yeah.
But it's part of learning socially how you deal with your Eat people,
your
isn't it?
Yeah.
I think it's appalling. I really do.
It's really restrictive, isn't it? And then the topics that kids are taught as well is all about getting ready for, you know, being in the kind of workforce that we have now. Whereas what you were introduced to are all life skills, isn't it? You know, I think a lot of younger children don't even necessarily understand the food that they're eating and things like
that.
They
get taken to school in cars. Mm. They're not very good. You watch them on the roads, you know, and so many aren't they? They're really unsure. You know, because they're ferried about here, and then, of course, they want to be ferried. You know, you're going to run as, you know, does that, all that sort of. There's still a lot of kids walking up and down from up there. I mean, I know that, but, yeah. Well, you don't lose out on the street. Kids aren't stupid.
Yeah.
You soon spot the odd man, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And you are stupid if you never. If you're never given the experience, you don't know how to handle anything.
No, you don't.
You learn from your mistakes, don't you, ultimately?
Yeah. And we knew, especially when you got into second year, that, I mean, the language was laser proof. There was no real thought process about, obviously, mainly men messing about with kids. That, I don't recollect that being in, but we always knew, maybe there was, but we just knew that they were a bit odd and we didn't feel right about
it. It was more
them,
intuitive.
You know, and I know that, you know, that we were all right, you know.
Yeah. You learn to be resilient, don't you? And you learn to protect yourself.
You
know, I think
that's not going near him again, you know. Sad sometimes, because it might just have been a person who was just a bit odd, you know, but was perfectly fine. But we had a really, really good brass band.
I was gonna tell me more.
We had a good choir and we had a great drama. That school just had so much going for it. And some of my mates used to say I couldn't play an instrument, so I didn't go for that, but I got into drama. You know, you did that in third and fourth years, and it was great, because they're saying again, I think I was growing up a lot quicker than most of my male friends, because, what are you going to ask girls, you know? And I said, exactly.
I
sang in the choir for the same reason. And it was just, and also, when you did the school play twice a year, I think it was, you didn't do the first two periods. You came in at 11 o'clock.
Okay.
You know, and these stupid boys, you know, they couldn't you get anything, you know, because we wouldn't be home till, I think the school play would be 7:30, something like that, start. So it would be 9:15. And there was no fear about you walking home.
Yeah. So there was a massive arts part to the school, because, I mean, we met, you mentioned it earlier, but we met at the Puzzle Inn, which was just down the road from where you grew up. And we struck up a conversation there, didn't we? And straight away got onto a shared love and passion of music. And so it's interesting to hear that the school that you went to, even, you know, first of all, there's all that practical side of thing, but they absolutely had the whole art side of it as well.
Never mind the sort of art and using clay and what have you. I now think it was a bit patronising, but once a year the BBC Schools Division would come and record the brass band and the choir, as a way of showing what secondary schools could achieve to grammar schools. And it didn't sit right with me. And of course, as I got older, you know, and you get a bit more knowledge about the world, you know.
You realise it wasn't right.
Yeah. But so it was good because, I mean, both were good at what we did. Mm. I don't know why, I just didn't go into learning an instrument. I'm not sure why.
Is there still access to them recordings then? Are they still available?
I have no idea, they might be. But they were probably ditched, as the BBC did in them days, you know. You just reused it, the tape.
Yeah, you reused
and stuff
the tape.
Like that.
Yeah. Before the times of digital.
Yeah, well, yeah, long before, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, it may be, you know.
So you sang in the choir, but you didn't pick up an instrument in the brass band?
No, well, A, it was never offered to me, and B, I didn't bother asking, so maybe I wasn't that bothered, you know.
So where did your love of jazz music start then? You had all that introduction to music at the school, but there must have been something that brought you to jazz.
I was listening again in the final year. That was when it was beginning music aimed at younger people, generally teenagers, although I don't think we were called teenagers just then. And I used to knock around with two or three cousins and their mates who were like 2, 3, maybe even 4 year older. They were listening to the pop music of the day, the beat bands, as they used to be called. And it just struck a chord with me. I really like this.
Mm.
And because, you know, they were listening and I was just hanging on. And then there was Radio Luxembourg, of course.
Mm.
That did a lot for music and people in this country. It faded in and out on your wireless, you know. You know, you could actually record it if your dad was well enough off to buy a little tape recorder for you. So that came. But I listened to black music really early on via these rock and roll records.
Okay.
And
how did you get access to records then? Was like somewhere... Years ago, when I first moved to the area, I found an old record that had actually been pressed at King Cross.
Oh, yeah.
So was there a pressing plan at King Cross?
Not to my knowledge. Unless it was a one where you could just do one... They used to have that thing you could go and record in a booth and record a song and it would be out on plastic.
Ah.
That there was quite a few of them around. And you'd see them a lot at seaside places as well. Now, I do know there was one like that in Halifax Town, one of the arcades. That isn't there now, and there's another long story, I suppose. And so when I got to 15, I was out and about. Mm-hmm. You know, I went to what was called the Plebeians then, you know, a jazz club, a very sort of Dixieland-type place, and I wasn't all that bothered. Bumped into my art teacher there. She said, what are you doing here? I said, well, what are you doing here? You know? She said, all right. Truce, I said, okay, and I never mentioned it, and she never did.
So was that local then?
That was up Halifax, yeah, just trying to learn a bit. And very quickly, by then, I'd be out of school at 15, going on 16, and we used to wait up at George a bit. I used to have a gruff voice, you know, but my mate who I used to go with was much taller than me, but I don't think he shaved. He was about 20, you know. He was all pink and they wouldn't serve him. I reckon that was in it, got changed then to the Good Moat Club and what have you, which was very much then a sort of, not a pure Northern Soul one. It was as much Motown as Northern Soul, but it was on a circuit of all the bands coming out from London, you know, up there, Friday, Saturday, Sunday nights. But it was a proper club you joined.
Yeah. So you actually became a member.
Oh, yeah. Might have been half a crown, I can't remember. Yeah.
And that was in Halifax as well?
Mm, that's in the Upper George Yard.
Oh, in the Upper George, right. Yeah.
Death Trap. So it's when got you look at it now.
Right.
You know, I went in before it was pulled down and it was a narrow staircase and that was the only way in and out.
And out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's a brief chat about the formative years, you know. But yeah, black music, just it hit me.
Uh-huh.
You know, I just was not listening to, once I found out that a lot of the hit singles over here were covers by local, but British singers, you know, and the black groups that should have been getting the credit for it were, you know, and I mean, that's how it was then. They were just learning to play and learning to, there weren't many songwriter teenage musicians, you know, if any, really, in the very early 60s.
So you heard a lot of that stuff on Radio Luxembourg then,
pop. But then an older cousin of mine, John, was in the Merchant Navy. And that was the real kicker. Levi's and real music. You know?
Yeah. So I'm guessing he was Merchant Navy over to the States.
Oh, yeah. That's regular, you know. Yeah.
Whereabouts in the States did he used to go?
That's where a lot of our jazz musicians went. They'd go on the Queen, whatever, all the cruise ships. And some of them had jumped ship, you know, and not come back for a while. Others would have about 5-day turnaround. So it was off. Straight in, was it 57th Street or something? But
so was that around? Was the cruising over? Well, going on the Navy wasn't exactly cruising, was it? With the Merchant Navy, but was his destination like New Orleans or was it New York?
No, they went to New York.
So
that was that. You know.
Yeah.
I guess some have might done, but John stayed doing it quite a number of years. You know, he wasn't a musician. He's just like that run. And it could bring, as I said, bring Levi's back and sell them, you know, and all that stuff, you know, yeah.
So which were the records that he brought back that you really
struck a chord? Well, early soul and some what they used to call R&B, which is now sort of soul music, you know. To us it was like a sort of blues band, rhythm and blues, you know, and that's always a strange one. And then I think I've got a nice sense of the absurdities of life, because I remember listening to Little Richard and just going, fuck's sake, you know, listen to this. And then, of course, the Midwest cuckoos, you know, all the religious bloody numpties in the Midwest of America thought, you know, this is killing our children, you know, it's all right, you know. What I didn't know at the time was he was gay. Mm-hmm. And he used to wear makeup and everything, and think, because we didn't see photographs. However, and you won't, I guess, know about this. So some record company said, well, we've got to beat them at their own game. So they brought a crooner in called Pat Boone, who sang Tutti Frutti.
All right.
But he sang it, oh, Tutti Frutti. Oh, my routine, as slow as that.
Oh, really?
A fucking howl.
Just completely different.
And at that tender age, I just got it, you know.
Yeah, you just realised. Yeah.
What a lot of bollocks, yeah.
So is there any artists that really stand out in your memory from them early recordings?
Yeah, I mean, there was Jerry Lewis, there was people, you know, Sam Cooke early days, and then a bit further up, Ray Charles, and there's a lot I can't remember the names of now, but it was, you know, it just comes back to me if I go through my collection. just tons of it, and before LPs.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
So there was all that happening.
So how did that compare to the music that was coming out over here at that same time? What kind of music were popular over here?
Well, it was similar, but it's because we didn't apart London apart and maybe one or two other cities, Cardiff and Liverpool, or Glasgow up north. There weren't many black people around then. So, you know, you were hearing this and you knew what it was, and then of course, like Melanie Maker was out, so you could get an idea. And it was genuine. You just knew the difference.
It was more heartsy.
Yeah, oh, it's all here. You know. That's why I dance from the hips, as black folks do, you know. Not that. Yeah. And I guess it was just in me.
Mm.
You know, that was a lot to do with it. You could just feel when something was just... And then the Motown stuff started and Stax, you know, and all that. Atlantic, you know, and then hitting the more modern jazz players as well, you know, and I just thought, this is where I just want to be. Most of my mates around here weren't, but it didn't matter. I mean, they like the soul stuff, you know, and, yeah, and what have you, so yeah, that was okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you started like listening to a whole range of different stuff.
But the whole thing, it was new.
Mm.
You know, bland young people till you got married. Thank God I missed all that, you know. I don't know how I'd have coped, because there was something in me that wasn't having anything like that at all. I used to fall out with my dad, you know, a lot in the early days. Yeah, from about 14 on.
Yeah.
He created fuck, because at 30, my mum had snuck out and went and got me some long trousers. You shouldn't have long trousers in them days till you were 14.
Oh, really?
He went nuts. And the year or so leading up to that, as you walk down to the navigation, the left-hand side, there were some old derelict houses there, but there was still sort of, the frames, doorways were open. So I used to hide in a paper bag my trousers and my good shoes in there, and I'd go home in shorts.
And then come just to out avoid, and just to avoid.
Because I used to go, because there was a lot of cafe society in Sobey Bridge, as elsewhere, in that late 50s as well, you know.
Explain cafe society. What is cafe society?
Well, they were coffee cafes. Mm-hmm. There was no real food there. You get crisps or nuts. Always a good jukebox doing all, and the pinballs and all that sort of stuff going on. And they were all 4 or 5 year older than me, people in there, right? Nobody, they didn't bother me.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't bother them. I think they just accepted whatever, do you know?
Yeah. Well, one of them, the Bluebird, because there used to be a place near the market called the Bluebird Cafe.
Yeah.
And when I first moved over to the area, that always struck me as being a place that would have had like games in there.
That's the one that's Cafe 5 now, isn't it?
Do you know, I can't remember.
It's on the corner?
Yes.
Yeah, yeah. There was that first time I knew it as a cafe, it was run by a Chinese couple.
Okay.
And I guess not long in the country, because they were just doing whatever we ate, you know, chip sandwiches or whatever.
Yeah.
And then another couple came, an English couple bought it. And they started to put these pinball things in.
Mm-hmm.
And then a school friend of mine, she lived, funny enough, full circle, she just lived up the same area of Chura Lane that we're talking about. Okay. The houses that are pulled down now, I can show you all these. And we got on a bit. I think, that's right, I've lost my thread about that. What was the start with that one?
You were saying about the couple that had bought the cafe.
Oh, yeah, that's right, her mum and dad. Yeah. Took it on.
So
I used to be able to get in, you know, Susan right. Brooks, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
But that's where they used to live, and then they moved down there and lived upstairs.
Above the cafe.
Yeah,
yeah. Because the big buildings as well, aren't they?
Oh, they're massive, yeah.
Yeah, huge inside. Brilliant.
Yeah, so that, and a lot of the bikers use that one.
Right.
Because
the market was just around the back.
Oh, yeah, good market. Yeah. I used to meet my mum 5 o'clock when she'd finished work and go down and get a lot of the shopping for the week.
Yeah, yeah.
And you'd walk up to East Parade, because that's where we lived then. You wouldn't dream of getting a bus, you know.
Yeah, yeah, just do the So the Puzzle Inn pub, which is the heart, really, of a lot of this, isn't it? You grew up just with that just down the road from you, but I can imagine you probably weren't allowed inside there for a long time.
No, so but I didn't even know it existed.
You didn't know it was there.
No.
So how did you find out about it? When was the first time you went?
When you think Chapel Street is above it, I don't know. If I get it right, I mean, I've been drinking a bit, but in other little pubs that, you know, you got away with. And I went with a couple of lads, 16, 17 year old, who I knew, off the street. He said, "You fancy coming out for a pint?" I said, "Can you get them yet?" I said, "Well, yeah, it depends where I go, but I'm not too bad, you know." Well, we go down to this little place on Ollinsmead Lane, of course, because that's just above Ollinsmead Lane there. And we went in, and he never even asked me, didn't Harold? your old landlord.
So that was the landlord, yeah. Harold.
And I thought, I like this place. You could just feel the atmosphere in many ways was just as it is now, but in a more working class working way, you know, yeah. During the mills, the lads. Mm-hmm. So none of them would have read a book or what have you, you know, it's quite different in that way. But I learnt very quickly, they were all serious buggers, you know. They made you laugh, they were, you know, they were renegades, you know, you've got, you know.
Rebellion, rebellion.
In their own way, you know. Yeah. And Ward's Beer from Sheffield, that's who owned the pub at the time, was maybe 2 or even 3% stronger than the local brews. So halfway down, especially as a young lad, halfway down your third, you knew you'd had a drink, you know. Uh-huh. And they were just characters, the lot of them, and I just felt so much at home there.
And was it a music venue then? Was
no,
there still
nothing
music?
Like, no, it? Nothing oh. like that at all. It was a pub.
Right.
And that was it, with a tap room that women weren't allowed in, except if you were a waitress, mm-hmm. you know, with that was everywhere. You know, that wasn't
that was the thing then,
that
wasn't
was
it?
The thing. Mm. Although a lot of pubs around here had a little, there's another small room for women.
Oh, right, women only.
Oh yeah. See, and there's a mayor, don't walk in there.
That's
depending
not a bad idea.
The age that you went in, mm-hmm. of the women there, mm-hmm. you might not come out with your trousers. I mean, oh dear me.
Dangerous.
Oh yeah.
Was there some warning signs on the door before you went in?
Yeah, yeah. So that was...
So because the layout is of the puzzle is different now, isn't it? Now, I used to go over, and we talked about this when we've chatted about how how I got to know the puzzle, and it were a completely different layout. And I remember when I first went to the puzzle, the bar probably was about a metre long, if that. And that was
it had a right angle into what the bar, that was the what used to call it, Nanny Hall.
Right.
That worked Friday and Saturday night for, you know, when man and wife were coming out. Mm. But there was just a little hatch there.
Yeah.
And when you walked through, when you walked in, immediately you were walking by a glass and wood, what do you call it, like a wall in. And there was a door there. That was the tap room.
Mm-hmm.
I can't think of the word just at the moment. But anyway, so that was there, and then there was no door at the bottom end to go to where the toilets are now.
Oh, right.
That was it. So you turned immediately right, and the bar was there in front of you.
Yeah.
Like that. And where the toilet is now, that didn't exist.
Okay.
You only walked about that far. And then there was a trapdoor down into the cellar.
Right, okay.
Because the cellar proper is very, very old.
Uh-huh.
Very old indeed. Where the cellar is now used to be a place where he kept his crates of ale and his empties and all that. That mm-hmm. wasn't the cellar at all.
Right.
But the beer used to be delivered in 36s. Gallon, a massive one.
Right.
And that one would last a good while. So that went into that shed.
Yeah.
And then there's at the end of it, there was a little drop where they would roll the barrels in,
mm-hmm.
and then the guys would put it up for landlord and what have you. That was it. Mm-hmm. And then in the middle of what we call the beer garden now, that was the toilet block.
All right, so it was outside, of course.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
I'd never even thought
men and women,
that, but it would have been.
Except
yeah.
in winter when it was cold, the women went upstairs to the pub's own toilets while men had to go out with a bucket of water and a bucket of fucking fire ashes to spread on snow and ice so you didn't
So you didn't go
over.
Falling as you were on your way down to the toilet.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
Yeah.
So then...
So what year would that have been then?
Oh, well, it was still there when I was going there to start with, so we're talking mid-60s, maybe a little... Yeah. I think it was like that until the late 70s and it got changed then.
Right.
Yeah. Part of us felt it was a retrograde step because putting a toilet inside never worked. It was always getting blocked.
Right.
So there were men's and women's then put into where they are now.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. And then, of course, they knocked that bloody doorway out. You know, from, shall we say, the band stage, you know, to go through.
Yeah.
So that was it. I still miss the nights when there was no music on and it was just sheer lunacy. You'd have 12 different conversations in the bar. Oh, we all used to gather in the tap room at the time about anything. It was, you know, it was great.
Yeah, yeah, just bouncing.
I miss that. I really, truly do, you know.
So were you the first person to bring music into that space?
Not then? Far off. What happened was, very early 80s, 80, 81 maybe, there was a music producer called Bill Leader, brilliant man, moved into the area, Great London, and he'd worked for Warner Transatlantic, and he'd, based in London, I guess, and so he'd been an employee, and he decided he wanted to come and have his own studio, and he's dead now, sadly, he moved to Manchester, to Salford, to teach recording facilities at Salford College there. So he'd heard about it, and I hadn't met him, but he popped down a couple of times, because the pub does draw people, you know. And it was all very late 70s, mid-70s, when I was going in the pub, that it started to change. I'd introduce some people in there, because, that period was still the 60s in many ways, you know, so we used to go in, you know, and have drinks, and it was just a good pub. We all liked it. The beer was good. And so there wasn't music happening then. So it was 1980, sometime in that year, I can't remember when. He'd come down with a band called the Mekons at the time, who I think were Leeds based. And he said, come on, let's go down there. I'll take you to this little pub. You'll love it. Bring your guitars, you know. And all right, off we go. And they just loved it. And that's when Brian and Mary were in at the time. He got, right, I know what I do. If we pull this lockdown, we can get more people in, you know. And that's that was a start. It was a long time before it got pretty much ruined. But it was nice because you could have meetings in there at the time as well. You know, so it's all like little glass with you know, that old-fashioned bottle top type of thing in there. Partition, I suppose you'd call it. Oh, it was a room divider, really. But anyway, so that's really when. And then Pete Coe came down with his people, and they were doing some sessions. And great player. I mean, we've always had good musicians around here, very quietly plying their trade, unlike Ebden, when it's all in your face, you know. And theatre people, and a lot of the stuff I was doing, there was just lots, you know. Quiet. Loved it. Cheap. Didn't have much money, but they could afford to... Some of them could afford to buy something big enough for half the size of this, but put a studio in it. Studio's a very grand term. Lots of people say, oh, you know, but they're often just done in tiny places.
Yeah. So you don't need a lot of room for recording sometimes.
No.
So when them musicians rocked up with the guitars, they actually played...
Oh, yeah, they didn't have to, but it's a, you know. Yeah, okay. And then another band called Kids How It Will, same thing, recording... they came down, Pad Along. I don't know if you've come across Pad yet. And they played a little bit, and they really liked it. And it went on a little bit. And then, not sure what happened then. And there'd be the odd little thing going. And then, so it was a bit come and go then. They'd often be just, there were a lot of folk is using it. So you might only be somebody afternoon or Saturday night or whatever, just having singing songs, because I'd probably go and do other things. And then it would be towards the mid-late 80s when I was somebody put the odd blues band on, you know, but, and I was talking to Anne and Jerry, Sam's mum, and her partner at the time, they'd taken the pub on. She said, we could do some music, Jeff, what do you think? I said, I'd like to get some jazz going. Okay. And she said, ooh, could you do it? I said, yeah, because by then I'd been working in the field of jazz for 5 years. So I'd already got contacts.
Right. Yeah, yeah.
And we did it. And it was fucking mobbed out, the very first one we did.
Brilliant.
I think it might have been September, maybe. Gary Boyle. You know, brilliant. What
was the work you'd been doing up until that point then? So you'd been working in it for 5 years?
Well, I was still doing industrial work until because this is another chapter in a sense.
Mm-hmm.
So in the early days of very late 60s, early 70s, I won't go to too much detail now. I'll just give you a thing. Some people moved into Triangle, which is where I was living at the time with my family. Mm-hmm. And I thought, these look interesting people. And we were up the Alma, we used to drink a lot up there. So I just had a chat with them. They just moved in, they were sharing a house. And they said, we sort of work in performance art, you know, sort of like theatre. And they saw me look. I said, I don't quite know what you mean. So they tried to explain it a bit. They could see I just...
Didn't know.
Why don't you come with us? We've been fitting up in Leeds, a university. Just come and see what we do. So I'm all up for anything. So off I went. And I just loved it. So I didn't know what it was. It wasn't speech. It wasn't drama, you know. Yeah. It was all about making things and what have you, by a group called John Bull Puncture Repair Kit. You can find him online still, on the web.
So that's a John...
Bull Puncture Repair Kit.
John Bull Puncture Repair Kit.
And at that time, I didn't know, it was quite a movement since about 1968. Lots of this performance art. And it pretty much in this country formed in this area. It came out of Bradford College.
Mm.
There was... groups and the Welfare State or Welfare State International, sometimes they call themselves. They used to live in showman's vehicles and tour around and spend 3 weeks doing something.
Right.
John Bull started similar time. A lot of it emanated from that nucleus. And there were other groups around, you know, so very well thought of. And it was a time when you could get grants, not much money, but, you know, you could... And everyone said, off you go and do it. You know, the Arts Council now is just, you know, completely different, of course. And I went, I just absolutely fell in love with it. I went the second night. I said, can I come again? And they said, yeah. And up to this time, I've been working away a lot already, you know. Joyce, my wife at the time, Dad always worked away, so she was very used to it. You know, right. She was one of five siblings, you know, and her mum, they just... got on with it.
Mm-hmm.
So she was quite happy for me to be doing that sort of work. And probably got rid of me as well, you know, to get out from under my feet. And so we went back and then they'd said, our driver come, technician, is, he doesn't want to do it anymore. He's not very well. We found someone who could drive the truck. Would you come along and work with him? Well, what would I do? I said, oh, well, we'll think of something, you know. And I said, well, you know, I don't know anything about what I'm doing, but I always have been. I've never found anyone. I've always said, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because I didn't know then. But years later, I began to understand that people were seeing in me something that I didn't even know I had. And it was a confidence, but I never felt confident, really. And I said, okay, well, I'll come down. And so we get fitting it all up down at the original Birmingham Arts Lab on Summer Street. And so we get in, and I didn't know the language either, you know, but you're getting on there. And right, we'll do this now. And so we'd like you fancy doing lights and doing some bits of special effects, you know. So, well... Okay, so I was there helping her hang the lights, and there was an in-house technician there who was showing me what to do and what the various lights do and how they cover and what have you. And then he said, sit with me on the dress run through, you'll be all right, because then these lads never do anything too complicated in terms of lighting. And so we set them, and we set them, you know, the lights and the... how strong or whatever we wanted them. Mm. Wrote it all down, bricking myself on the opening night. But I got through. I don't think I meant many fluffs. And also we were doing some projection on, I think it was the first rank. It was a roller where you put the... So it wasn't, you know, shoving them in and out like that. Mm. I can't really... Probably... Have you ever seen that? Maybe not. No. Carousel.
Oh, yes, yeah, yes. Yeah. I know what you mean.
So they were fairly new at the time. So Tim, who I knew well anyway, the group also, John Darling used to do it, he made up all the soundtracks on the legendary Revox reel-to-reels. They were brilliant machines. Mm. So he'd be operating that, you know, and all that business. But some John would also put a bit of a blank thing in which stopped it anyway, you know, so you couldn't mess it up, but you had to start it again. Yeah. And then there were special effects that we might have blood hitting something. So we used to go through miles of fishing line, you know, because you couldn't really see it in the light, so you'd tie something up. And that's why I fell in love with this type of theatre, because it wasn't electronic at all, you know, you had to make things happen. So for these blood to hit this white coffin, as an example, you know, I don't know what material it's like, I guess it's like a glass, like globes that you put on Christmas trees.
Yeah.
You know, you can flick them and they can break quite easily.
Yes.
So you take them off and you'd get some washing up, plain washing up liquid and some red food dye and mix it, put it back in, run the fishing line over to where I was, and at the right time, I just cut it, and it would drop down and smash, and there'd be just blood everywhere.
Right.
People used to say, "How do you do that?" So I'm not telling you. Why? I said, already I've got the magic of theatre. I just, it was just so much to me, and I absolutely love that, you know. Yeah.
And what a way to get into it as well, just through neighbours that you'd got to know and got talking to and showing an interest. You said really early on about, even when you was a kid, you were curious. And even when you were a kid, you'd explore. You'd be like, what's down that road and what's up here and what's around there?
I did.
So that's kind of been with you all along, hasn't it?
Absolutely. I used to drive my mum and dad mad to a point. But then again, they were sort of all right, you know. Dad, you played out anyway, you know, as if you just on the street. And I walked all over Sobey and Hubberton without knowing where I was.
And Hubberton's quite a way out from here for kids.
Yeah.
Isn't it? Like Hubberton's.
Well, by then I was living in Sobey.
Ah, so you were up on the tops. Yeah.
We moved up onto housing estate.
Is that new?
Just now? About 5-6 year old, I think.
Oh, so you were still quite young then.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And we moved up. We didn't last very long. We moved back into Sobey Bridge. I think we were up there about a year.
Oh, so not long at all then.
No. But, and I just set up.
Yeah,
and it was just great. Yeah. You know?
And we're surrounded by beautiful countryside here as well, haven't we? We've got it on our doorstep.
So at home.
Yeah. Have you ever lived anywhere else? Have you lived? I mean, you mentioned Triangle, which is just down the road.
Yeah, I lived there for quite a number of years with Joyce, and our kids were born there. And we lost one of our kids there, and let me just see. Lived in Amsterdam for a while, a bit New York. And up in Glasgow for a while. I mean, I've always wanted to come back here because it's not, I can't leave, bollocks to that. And all the touring I did, you know, and what have you. But, And then parts of the jobs working away. I'd be working away for 6 or 7 weeks at a time, 7 days a week. Come home for what was laughingly called a long weekend.
Mm-hmm.
But you'd finish about dinner time on Friday. Get home late Friday night, sometimes too late for the pub. And then you'd be going back Monday to start Tuesday.
So that's not a long weekend at all, is it?
No. But you see, Joyce was fine because, as I said earlier, that's what her dad did.
So she was used to that.
Always working life, you know.
Yeah. And was then when you were working away for like 7-8 weeks, was that around the UK, or did you find yourself eventually going abroad?
No, that was the UK.
Yeah.
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 Top to bottom.
Doing all the same, like performance arts, theatre, production.
Well, but this was industrial work.
Yeah.
Some of the tours I did with this is why it'll keep coming, because there's so much
that
I worked, you know, as a lighthouse painter for a year, and that was Joyce's dad.
Oh, my word.
Because he was an industrial painter. Right. So you see, it's all a little bit here and a little bit there.
Yeah.
I used to go down off Chapel Street with my little three-wheeler with a hood at the back to get the National Dried Milk for my next brother.
Okay.
And I pedalled, so I'd be about four. So I went down proper Chewell Lane, onto Railway Bridge, across the zebra crossing,
uh-huh.
on Station Road, to
yeah.
Allen House.
Right.
Which is where I got these big tins of milk that you got on prescription. Well, you got given it. And then I'd cycle all the way back.
You see, and for some people that live somewhere flat, that might not sound like a lot, but we are surrounded by hills.
Yeah.
So the route down, you would have been downhill, but that coming back up,
getting back up,
would have been.
I got off and pushed. But you know, it's there's just so much more. I grew up off Chapel Street around Hollins Street, and there's a chapter in Hollins Middle Lane alone.
Uh-huh.
I didn't get to the pub. I found the library.
Oh, yeah.
Snotty nose, didn't know what it was, walked in, and I must have, four? And I wandered in and had a look, and I'll never forget her. I can see her face. I wish I could have bloody met her again to just thank her. Put it in, and I looked around and she said, hello, are you looking for something? And I can remember this. Well, what is it? Oh, she said, it's a library. And, you've got books. She said, yeah. Would you like to look at one? Can you read? I said, yeah. So she took me to the very simple ones. And I just, 2 pages in, she said, you've been reading a little while, haven't you, lad? I said, well, I can't remember. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So she wrote a letter out. She said, take this to your mum and dad, and here's 2 books for you. When you finish them, come back and you can change. And she just explained, apparently, to my parents, he's not stopped with them. You know, he's, I'm amazed he can really read.
Yeah. Do you remember what the 2 books were?
I do. Middle Class American Crap, as I know now.
Uh-huh.
The Bobbsey Twins.
I've never heard of them.
No, you wouldn't. And this is when I started to understand about aspects of life. I read both books in, I can't remember which one, there was this little gypsy boy they found. Now, this is America. I don't think they had gypsies in caravans in America. I didn't know then. And they played with him and they talked about what he did and where they lived. And mummy, mummy, daddy, daddy, can, I can't remember his name, come and have dinner, lunch with us. Well, of course, you know, they came in and it was soup and the little gypsy boy started dunking his bread in and they were all horrified. The kids were, because they were never allowed to do that. But looking at, I can see the faces of the parents, they were all going, oh no, it's okay. Every fucker dunked their bread. So all of a sudden I'm getting, what's wrong with this thing? Middle class life, as I didn't know, but came to it later.
Yeah.
And I thought, and then I went down and there was books about the Midwest, I guess, or somewhere with this orphan living with his grandparents. And the guy who used to look after him, I can't remember his name. There were pictures as well. It was text, you know. He was drawn as a very tall man with lots of blonde hair. He might have been Swedish or something over there. And they christened the little boy Little Fella, you know. And I read a couple of them and they were sort of okay.
Yeah.
Amazing, isn't it, really, when I look back?
I mean, it just goes to show, doesn't it, that, like, if you hadn't walked into that library that time and happened to have met the woman running the library, you could have had a really different response to you as a 4-year-old, you know, going in.
Yeah.
That she, so I'm imagining that them first two books with the letter back to your mum and dad led to a whole host of exchanging, going back and getting other books and going back and getting other books.
I can't, because at that age it's still a bit, you know, I can't remember. I know I still went, but I can't quite remember. Remember the other books. But a little older, I was never really bothered about the Beano and Dandy, the graphic comics.
Yes, like the graphic,
I read text.
Yeah.
And so there was Victor, was the Hotspur, and there might have been a third one. I can't remember. Definitely those two. And they were just text stories, and I'm in there, you know. It's just, it's great. Never stopped.
Yeah. So is the library still the same library as where it is now?
Yeah.
It's a lovely building, isn't it?
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And next to that was the council building, the swimming baths, and the fire station.
That's right.
That, all that same stretch.
And you missed a bit. The derelict plot next to the bar, that used to be Central Cafe. And it was black and white, you know. It was waitresses with the caps.
Oh,
I remember going twice to once to my granny's funeral,
once
to someone else's funeral, you know.
Yeah.
But the I think the cellars fell in, which is why it's all somebody's bought it now. I think that plot.
So that's why it drops off so much at that section.
Yes.
There. Right. Okay.
And where the bar is now, that was Sidlin Hilton's office. You know, the company I told you about a little earlier. That's there.
So that's what is currently Coogee Bar, is that right? The one on the corner?
Something like that.
Because Sorby Bridge is amazing, because you can drive through it and you can get stuck in the traffic and all you see is an old town.
Yeah.
But when you walk through it and you take your time,
The
architecture's stunning.
Yeah.
Some of the buildings are absolutely stunning.
Look at Martin's Bank, opposite Kiffling's, is it? Just... I always tell people, look up.
Yeah.
It's all there.
Yeah, it's stunning.
Luckily, I remember the town when there were still gas lights on some of the side streets.
Yeah.
I've seen it change an awful lot. And I'm very glad I was around to watch that happen.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. What's the bits about the town that you miss the most that are there now?
The traffic is bad.
Yeah.
You know, they keep measuring it. I don't know why they keep measuring it. You know, we know it's shitty, so stop it. Fumes.
It just never, I mean, it is complete standstill, isn't it? Most days, there'll be a period of time where it's a complete standstill.
I suppose it was that on an age, it was still exploring and just finding little gills, as we used to call them.
Mm.
And what's down here, you know what I mean? Because at that age, everything was a lot bigger than what it really was.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, everything was, you know, isn't it?
And it was, there's just so much of those early years, you know, you could spend ages.
Yeah.
I don't know how we're going to edit it down, to be honest.
Well, we've covered a lot about your early years.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking next time we have a get together, I'd love to hear more about your experience in the theatre and what that grew into.
Yeah.
And I'd like to go back into bringing music into the puzzle.
Yeah, okay. I think there's still a bit about my industrial life as well, but...
I don't know yet.
Don't forget, I left school at 15, which was 1962, you know, so there was lots of work around and what have you, but...
Working in the industry would be great to hear. You see, we've only ever talked in the pub about music, so I'm learning loads more about you as well. So, industrial.
There's just tons, Liz, you know. And there's a lot of it that just comes together, you know.
Mm.
And that's probably because it is a small town. I used to, at 10 o'clock on Saturdays, the civil defence alarm used to go off. That was so...
Is that what sounds like an air raid siren?
Yeah. And that was to do so you, in those days, so you could still hear the warning sign. If you couldn't hear it, you'd to let people know. And that was based in the fire station.
The one down Station Road as well?
Yeah.
Mm.
Yeah, so...
No,
on Holly's Mill Lane.
Yes.
Yeah, but before that, this is where I learnt about... I think of the word. I'll come back to that. Modern disappointment. Fire engine sign would go. Mm. The siren would go off. I used to run like fuck off Chapel Street down to see it going. Never caught it.
Oh no!
And then I was on one day.
There must have been swift out of there then.
And then I was down there one day when the doors flew open. The fire engine came out, and about 3 minutes later, that fucking siren went off. I'd been conned. Little lessons on Hollingsmill Lane, I'll tell you. It's just,
So all them times when you've been running down, it had gone way before
it's
the sun.
It had
already gone.
Bastards.
Oh, well, it's been great, Jeff.
Yeah.
We need to get another date booked in.
Yeah, well, whenever. I'm pretty free for a while at the moment, yeah.
Hello, listeners. So Jeff and I have come back together. We realised on listening to the recordings of session 1, 2 and 3, there were some additions and some rectifications we wanted to make to the recording. So welcome back. And we're going to just have a conversation to add some detail around session one.
Okay.
So Jeff, you mentioned in session one a man called Peter Blake.
Oh,
and when we listen to it back, it's actually a different name, isn't it?
Yeah.
Tell us more.
It was Peter Brook.
Peter Brook.
Yeah. Of course, I've got a print of his work up there, you know, on the wall. Did we go over why I'd got mixed up when we got into the gallery?
Yes. Well, we talked about it, but I think it would be worth recapping for the listener.
Okay. Mm. So I went off with a friend of mine, Fez, and found out that there was a sort of pop-art exhibition at the Albert Dock down in Liverpool. So I thought, oh, great, we'll go off and check that out. So we get there, and while we're waiting for someone to come, it was still part of the COVID time, so we had to, you know, book ahead in advance, and she was checking with our, you know, booking had gone through. And I'm saying to Fez, I'm looking round, and I said, Fez, I can't see any sort of, well, not so much merchandise, not bothered about that, but there's no posters or anything about this Peter Brook. Yeah, pretty, I nearly did it again.
Right.
Peter Brook, the Blake exhibition. And so when the young lass come down, I said, where is the Peter Blake exhibition? She looked at me quizzically, and she said, I don't think we have one. She said, I've not been here in just a couple of weeks, so maybe I've missed it somewhere.
Yeah.
And Fez is pottering around, having a look at other stuff. And she came back, no, nobody knows what's happened.
Uh-huh.
And she said, I'm going to ring somebody else who's been here quite a while. By this time, an invigilator, I think that's what you call them, had arrived, and he was hanging around maybe to just point us to the right place. And she said, it was 13 years ago when we had that.
So she found that after speaking to this sort of vigil writer.
Yeah.
Saying,
what's he up to?
You need a time machine.
It's just something I never think about. When I go online looking for something, I find it. I've realised now that I've got to look at the top because there's a date there that tells you when that was added.
Mm-hmm.
And I would have known all about it.
So tell us a little bit, like, who is Peter Brook then? How
Peter
do you
Brook
know him?
He died a little while ago now. He sells well, and he loves this area a lot of the moors, West Yorkshire. But he taught both at Raglan School and Sobeybridge Grammar as it was then.
Mm-hmm.
And also he did paintings often in the bad weather up on the tops. Always had his dog with him. Mm-hmm. And that was like a little feature, you know. So it was always a tiny
like
figure
a
and a tiny figure.
Yeah.
And he's still got an agent, the family has, opposite the parish church in Huddersfield, if anyone wants to go off. But he loved Sobeybridge.
Yeah.
He really did. He painted lots of it. And Chapel Street, which we touched on earlier, where I was born, he painted it either 6 or 8 times in various ways.
Yeah.
I think Chapel Street maybe 3 or 4 times as well.
Right.
And you know, from either end of the streets there. Yeah. And he used to grind up some of the millstone grit, our local stone, to put it into his oils, you know.
Okay.
So
the actual stone was in the painting?
Yeah, absolutely.
And for the listener, the image that we've used for this this one is one of his pieces of work.
That's right,
well,
it's Chapel Street from one end, and when you look at it, the first house on the left is where I was born all them years ago.
Yeah,
a bit of a rough place, but we didn't know that.
So did you ever meet him then?
No, sadly, no. I'd left Ryburn by the time he went there. Yeah.
What fantastic for the students at Ryburn to have him as a teacher, though. It must have been fabulous.
Oh, yeah. He was really down to earth, you know. But And my partner Margaret's got a small one at her home as well. Mm. That's one in the snow.
Yeah.
You know, but
So check out Peter Brook.
Oh yeah, you must. Yeah. Just great. Lots of West Yorkshire little towns as well as up on the tops. Yeah.
Fantastic. And then another one that we realised when we listened back is when you were talking about growing up in the area and what the area was like. You'd refer to it being really busy and a lot of activity, and we refer to it having over 60 industries.
Yeah.
But what we realised is it was actually businesses, over 60 businesses.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I wasn't too sure about the difference when I was thinking about, talking about that. But yes, I guess the businesses is probably a better description.
Because there would have been a number of businesses actually with the same industry,
especially
in the mill.
Yeah, I hadn't thought right through there. Mm-hmm. But it was very wide. We weren't just about textiles, which, lots of people used to think that's all it was. There were many mills, of course, but so a little heavy engineering, machine tool engineering, lots of medium weight in terms of what they were producing, but, busy. People were full-time work,
And when you look at pictures from that era as well, it was quite different to how it looks now. I saw a picture recently and it was looking down the river, just as though if you're looking down the river so that the rail track's on your left and the library's on your right. And when you looked at this image all the way down that side of the river, it was massive industrial buildings.
So are we talking looking down past the puzzle?
Yeah.
Well, at this where the narrow road that runs past the pub from the main road to an area where it climbs up there. It's an old pack horse route. What would it be? 200 yards. There were 6 mills there.
Mm-hmm.
Along
that route.
Yeah. And if you look to your right, just past the puzzle, across the canal, which was quite higher up, there was another big, big mill there.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know what they did because it was derelict. It had been abandoned when we were a little older enough to just pot around it, and get in there and create havoc.
There must have been quite interesting playgrounds.
Yeah.
And you were saying as well that one of the things that you'd like to talk more about, which we didn't get the chance to talk about during that episode, but we'll talk about now, is that you actually experienced rationing and that you remember rationing at the time.
Yeah, I didn't know what it was.
Uh-huh.
It was it was tobacco and sweets, and I think they were the last to come off rationing. I just have this memory of going with my mum and quite a lot of the other women on Chapel Street, just up the hill a bit. And then we stood outside in a queue by a local sweet shop and tobacconist.
Right.
And it's one of those little, flashes, vignettes of your life. I can't remember much before that particular time then we were going up there. And of course, I'd be too young to question why we were queuing. I wouldn't even know what that word was, but...
just remember being in that queue. Yeah. And was it, because it was rationing cards as well, wasn't it? You had to have a card and then you'd be given...
Yeah, I've still got mine somewhere and identity card, cardboard, tucked away. But it was opposite a little cobble pathway between that and the street higher up, Park Road, and quite street. And I was sort of playing around the bottom a bit and there were some older boys further up the top, and I heard all this yelling and bouncing. What the heck's going on? So I put my head further up. There's this bloody tar car wheel coming down.
Oh, my word.
I don't know how they got it, but they just let it go. And it bounced across the main road straight in the plate glass window of the sweet shop.
Oh, no.
Yeah. One of them's still alive that I know of. I'll be telling him. I haven't forgot.
Yeah.
I think he blamed his brother who went to live and work in South Africa.
Oh, that's handy, isn't it?
Yes.
And the final thing that we realise that not really provided enough information about was you'd referred to Kay and Nick.
Nick, yeah.
The who puzzle, ran the puzzle.
Yeah.
But yeah, tell us a little bit more about them.
Well, they moved in from the Bradford area. They knew the pub. We had friends who, and actually Sue, she's still running the Fighting Cock in Bradford, which is, you know, quite a very, very well-known, one of the very early pubs to start putting different brewers' beers on and things like that. So they took it over for a while. And we were just having a chat, and Nick was saying, and it was Kay actually, we could do a little bit of music here, couldn't we? You know, there was the odd folk thing, but that wasn't, it was too small and too noisy for, you know, folk gigs. I tend to like it to be very quiet, which is, I can understand. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why don't we try and put a jazz night on? Well, Nick, the guitarist of the family, he was up for that. Mm-hmm. And so, and it was with a friend of mine who's still playing as a regular jazz player, although he's not in the area at the moment. So with his early contacts, and I was just moving into that world for work as well at the time. So we rang around, we worked out that Tuesday nights would be the best, because that's one night when they're less likely to be working and what have you. So we quickly put a weekly programme together.
Oh, okay.
And it just took off. It was amazing. There were times we couldn't get in the pub. We had to bugger off to one down the road to get a drink. It was that
full. It was so busy.
Yeah. Although the numbers are relative. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can only get about 80, 70 people in, you know, and
that would be full. That would be very full.
It was frighteningly full.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and that went on for ages, and we were attracted, because there's great, great, you know, jazz musicians up around the north of England that choose not to go down to that London, you know.
Exactly.
So, there's no less of quality, even now, more so probably. And it was good fun. We really enjoyed it. And didn't get much money, you know. I think it was £50 to start with. Because it's 1989. It possibly might be 88, but I think it was 1989 when we kick-started it. And we thought we'd stop during the summer, and we were told on no uncertain terms by the customers, no, we want to come down. So we never dropped.
Just kept going.
Yeah, yeah. So I think we ran it 16 and a half, maybe 17 years, and we'd had a bit of a problem with a couple of the end of the line landlords there who weren't really interested. They'd come out of an area where they think, well, I should just sit in the corner of the bar, and, you know, and small pubs can't pay a lot of staff, and that's why they went bankrupt, you know, and things. So it was really sad. And people, and also the other reason why we started to lose custom was for the best reason in the world, really. There were people, maybe three or four, who'd all come to me and said, how do you do this, you know? Because we've realised, and we're sorry to say, that we're thinking, well, why travel? Because we're talking Ripon and Merseyside and Chesterfield, people travelling up. Yeah,
distances, yeah. Yeah.
Why don't we do it at home if you've made a go of it here? And do you mind if we talk to you about it? I mean, it wasn't all four at a time. It was, I said, of course not, you know. So we lost about 30% of it, you know. But that was good, you know. The best thing in the world to be able to do, and we proved it well.
Yeah. It's good for the jazz music scene as well, isn't it, be able to
Absolutely. Because the thing is, you know, there were no jazz policemen in there. You play what you play. We're booking you for what you do.
Yeah.
You know, don't tone it down, because we're out in sticks. You know, nobody will come. And that was great. So Pete, you know, Nikki Isles, I mean, she cut her teeth there when she was still at college. Mike Walker was another one. Steve Brown, drummer. There were just so many. And Stuart McCallum came through a bit later on, you know, guitarist. Gary Boyle, lovely, lovely man. He left the main music business. Had a band called Isotope, which was been on the jazz rock side, but toured the world. Was so popular. I really thought a lot of him. But he had rock and roll management, I think, and they wanted to do it in a different way, in a sense.
Yeah.
He wasn't interested in going out looking daft for, you know, label people to have photographs taken and, and all that. And so him and his wife, Georgie, they packed up, they came up here. Here, near Cone, over there. And they bred dogs for a long time.
Okay.
I think they were collies, I'm not sure. Something like that, spaniels. But he didn't, he still played now, and he'll be 80, 81 now.
Okay.
And he was one of the very first people to go on to the jazz course in Leeds.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
In the early days.
68, maybe, something like that. Yeah. And he's still playing. In fact, he's coming July, I think, or June.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is that to perform?
Yeah, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, he's still playing a lot.
Wow,
yeah.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
So the landlady and landlord, Kay and Nick, what was their full name then?
Gorham.
Gorham.
G-O-R-H-A-M, yeah.
So they had and was managing the Puzzle at that time?
Sadly, it was already owned by Punch.
Okay.
So they were going to struggle, you know, in common with many, many other poor buggers, you know, from that trade. Yeah.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Good Mood Podcast, a series that gathers together a rich mosaic of Jeff Amos's life experiences in performing arts and music. Hosted by myself, Liz Leach, we look forward to you joining our next episode. In the meantime, please subscribe to the series, recommend to friends and family who you think would be interested in this topic, and remember to visit Jeff's website, jeffamos.wordpress.com. We look forward to you joining us at the next episode.